until just before 6 o'clock, if it lasts that long. And essentially what we will do is, John, I don't know if you have any opening comments, and then we just throw it open to questions from the audience.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What I thought I would do is give the council a quick report of the listening session so far, so that you can benefit from what others have said, and then open it up to both members of the council and the public to give me their feedback. Does that make sense as a plan? I came to work on August 6th, had an all-hands meeting at the regional office in Gloucester, said that we were in a crisis situation and that we should respond to it as such, and that I wanted to spend a lot of time going out and visiting with people in their places of business as near as I could. And so I think I've probably spent less than 10 days in the office since that time, and I've conducted I don't know how many listening sessions in Virginia, Maryland, New Jersey, Long Island, Rhode Island, several sessions in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and several in Maine. And so haven't been in Connecticut yet, and there's a few others that I want to do with the fishing communities, with NGOs, and with a number of constituents. I don't know how many hundreds of people I've listened to, but it's certainly hundreds, maybe more. And visited with senators, congressmen, and lots of their staffers. And so briefly, I want to introduce Allison McHale. Would you raise your hand? Allison is one of the staffers who's had the misfortune of having to go along with me and try and keep notes, and she'll do that here today as well, because I find it hard to both listen and keep notes. And we're trying to tabulate in general ways the kinds of issues that people are raising so that we can put that on the website. I think it's already up. I noticed that today. So that people can learn, if they're raising an issue, that they're not the only person raising that issue. And so I want to give you about 10 or so issues that that more than one people are raising so that you can hear them. And then I'm interested in what you think. I started out thinking that what I wanted people to advise me is, what should I pay attention to? Given that time is the most precious and limited resource, and I can't possibly learn enough on all the issues that that we have to know about. I mean, we have very talented staff at the regional office. I feel like I'm trying to catch a plane that's halfway down the runway. I'm running as fast as I can. I'm never going to know as much as George here. Thank God. And so what are the 6 or 10 issues that I really need to learn about? What are they? And so seeking your advice and others about what are the 6 or 10 issues that I really need to know about, that's what I'm trying to find out. And what are those top 10? And then I said, I'll ask people, what would success look like? Well, you can imagine in 20 or 30 listening sessions, I've never gotten to that question, what does success look like? Because people have been focused on, you know, the top 10 problems. So maybe we'll have another round at some point about what does success look like. So what are the problems that people have raised? I would say invariably at every session, the one that dominates, Jim, I'm sorry to say, is science. You know, and it's people's distrust of the science and the way we do it. And in the 90s, I certainly got a lot of that message, but I also got that the science was wrong. There's lots of fish out there. I don't get that so much now. I get more that it's just we don't agree with the way it's done. And so, again, that's why Bill Karp is planning this, among other things. The November 9th event is not the only thing he's planning, but you know, it's not just one voice that's saying we don't have confidence in the way science is done. It's a lot of voices. It's prevalent. It's everywhere. And so I just have to emphasize that. And as we said, those of you who were at the Mid-Atlantic, Russ Brown was there, I said this boils down to, I think, two very separate issues. One is, do we have good science? That is one question we ask ourselves. And then the second question, which is an entirely different problem, is, do we communicate it effectively? Right? You can have very good science and not communicate it effectively. Right? I know the answer to the second question is we don't communicate it effectively. I know the answer to the second question is we don't communicate it effectively, because that's why at every single meeting people are saying, I don't buy it, right? So whether or not we've got good science, I know we're coming up short on the communicating it effectively. So we need to work, and Bill knows this better than anyone else. So, you know, I know that Bill is the right person. We've got the right person directing the Science Center. But that's something I hear everywhere. And, Logan, I don't want to leave you out there. I see you in the crowd, too, Logan. So I don't get as many. And maybe that's because Logan's the new sheriff in town. But I certainly get – and enforcement is a tough job. And I get some of those, not a lot, but some issues in enforcement. But now, getting into the area of management issues, certainly there is economic distress, and that is a message that is given in many different ways, very movingly, very urgently. You know, I was in Gloucester, but it doesn't matter. It's in every community I've gone to. And a guy sitting, you know, as far away from me as Terry over here just looks me straight in the eye and says, John, am I going to make it? You know, and it's that question has been asked of me over and over and over again. It is that question of economic distress. And he wasn't talking about, am I going to survive what's going to happen on May 1st, 2013. He wasn't thinking about May 1st, 2013. He was thinking about next week, next month, you know, up and down the coast. You all know this as well as I do. There is economic distress out there. You can call it social, whatever that term was, but, you know, it is impact that people are feeling. And it's real, and it's out there, and we all know that. As I talk to people in the Mid-Atlantic, in New Jersey, and places south, there is concern in healthy fisheries of transfer of people here feeling the pressure and transferring effort down and exerting pressure into healthy areas, and so they're worried about that, and that's a concern. As people express their concern about up here about economics, you can think of it in one sense about looking at the income side of it and looking at the expense side. You know, how do you get more income and how do you get less expenses? And so there are a couple of ways of thinking about increasing the income side. This council is already looking at, you know, the fisheries that are in good shape and how can we get access to them through looking at areas that were closed under the old regime based on effort controls and looking at, I don't know what you might call them, mortality closed areas and saying, can we responsibly open them because their usefulness as effort controls is not needed now the way we manage fisheries. So you're hard at work at that, and that might provide ways to get income in a responsible and sustainable way. And that's one tool that can be useful in providing income in a way that does not in any way threaten sustainable use of fisheries. I don't know that I've been to a meeting where people have not talked to me about the abundance of dogfish, and I'm interested in how we're not, utilizing the take that we're doing now, because I know we've increased fairly significantly the quota of that, and there's a marketing issue on that. So, but people have mentioned the prevalence of that species, and that represents, if we can be smart about it, potential income. So people have talked about, you know, there is income out there. There's income if we can be smart about how we use it. And they've talked about how we can reduce expenses, whether it's fishermen who are paying for it or the government's paying for it. The cost of observers is a tremendously high cost. The fishermen have said, you know, observers can be half the cost of a trip. And again, whether it's the government or the fishermen, it's half the cost of a trip. And you know, what are we getting for it? We're getting, what, 25% coverage? So it's not even that good a product because we're not getting that great coverage. So, you know, people smarter than me, oh, that's a large segment. This would more than fill this room. I can think about, is there technology? I suspect there is, where, you know, we might get a better product, 100% coverage, and this council and others might think of ways where you combine technology and full retention and get a better product of observers, 100% coverage, and no discards, and an upfront cost that might be paid if Congress can get economic assistance that would have a much lower cost of observer coverage that would then save whoever's paying for it the cost of observers. But that might reduce the cost side of the equation. I think people have also talked about, because fishermen, who's better observers of the marine environment than fishermen? I mean, you don't make any money if you're in the fishing industry if you're not a really good observer of what's going on out there. I asked fishermen in eastern Maine and Ellsworth, what do you see out there with temperatures? And then one guy said, it's always been 45 degrees, always been 45 degrees. And then, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it's 50 degrees. And I say, wow. 45 degrees to 50 degrees. That's amazing. He said, that's not amazing. This year it was 65 degrees. And I'm saying, I can't even believe that. 20 degrees? That's got to be a current change or something. So you all know temperatures are changing, currents are changing, and fish are moving. So what are the implications of that? You've talked about that already today, right? And so that has got to, when you have changes that profound, that has to change the way we manage fish, right? How does it change? How, not does it change, how does it change the way we manage fish? So I'm talking to guys who say, my state allocation is based on catches that we did in the 80s. State allocation's based on catches in the 80s. Now, how does that make sense when fish are moving as fast as they are moving in a northern, northward direction, which means that states are going to be losing fish, but they're also going to be gaining fish. Now, you guys are the pros at this. I'm not. I just came out of retirement and showed up 7 weeks ago in Gloucester. I don't know this stuff. You guys are the expert. But if fish are moving, why would you base how much fish a state gets on what someone was catching in the 1980s? That is ridiculous, right? So somehow or other, the New England Fishery Management Council and the Mid-Atlantic and whoever's to the south of the Mid-Atlantic needs to get together and say, if fish populations are moving in a northerly direction, then we need to start thinking about how we change the way we manage fish, because it means that new fish are going to be showing up at our doorstep and fish are going to be departing, right? And so we need to be saying, okay, how do we say hello to new fish and goodbye to old fish, right? But hanging on to allocations based on the 1980s is, that doesn't make sense anymore. So at any rate, that's, again, that's just what people are telling me in these listening sessions, and it makes sense to me. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I'm just passing it on for your edification. That's the NRCC is probably the right forum for that. And, you know, if you're talking about temperature changes, of course you have to talk about other changes that might be going on. And I know, Jim, you and your colleagues at the Science Center are looking at pH levels and all the other things that are going to impact the way fish stocks are impacted. I'd also say that there was, at all of these meetings, this is sad to say, actually, a tremendous appreciation for going out and reaching out. People seem very, very pleased that something as simple in going out and asking people what they think would happen. And so it suggests that maybe we should do more of that. So I probably will. Now, lastly, At every meeting, the issue of consolidation would come up. And it would be phrased in different ways. Sometime it would be phrased as access. Sometime it would be phrased as consolidation. Sometime it would be phrased as big boats versus little boats. But it would always come up. And I would usually respond that this is an issue that is properly discussed by the New England Fishery Management Council, that consolidation is happening and has been happening before sectors, and it should be addressed overtly. That is, it shouldn't just be allowed to occur while we're not paying attention, I don't think. This is my own personal opinion, that the regional office has encouraged the council to address this, and you have it in the form of Amendment 18. And tomorrow or the next day, I can't remember when priorities, is that Thursday the priorities come up? And I will talk more about this on Thursdays. You discuss priorities, but at a listening session in New Bedford on Wednesday, John Quinn was there. There was a very moving discussion because a young man from the Cape. Do you remember his first name, John? Brooke or something. He said, he said, I'm a small guy. My father, my grandfather was in fishing, and my brother's in fishing, and I want to have access to fishing. And I just want to be able to have access to fishing. And he was standing next to a person who's acquired quite a few permits. I won't name him. I'll just say if his first name was Carlos. But we'll just say he's acquired some permits. And so I was standing right next to this anonymous person. We'll just call him Carlos for the hell of it. And so we had this interesting discussion about what the future of fishing should be in New England. And I said, you know, I don't know whether 5 or 10 years from now, you know, the New England groundfish fishery will be owned by 3 or 4 people. But if that's the vision of fishing, you know, we should take a vote on that, right? If that's what we want fishing to be, then we should take a vote on that. It shouldn't just happen when we're not paying attention. It should be something we vote on. Because I think if you ask people, whether you ask elected officials or whether you ask the members of the New England Fishery Management Council, or whether you walk outside here and go down on the sidewalk and ask people, I don't think that's what they would vote for. But that is kind of, you know, what's going on. So that is really the discussion about Amendment 18. And that comes up, that issue comes up in every meeting, whether or not, you know, that young man and that young man's voice was given at every meeting. Every meeting, that young man is present at every meeting in some form or another. So I want to lay that out as well, because that issue is out there. And so in this council, that takes the form of Amendment 18. And it is something, you have had a huge amount of stuff on your plate, and there's still, you know, it's always this much stuff on your plate, right? It's still that amount of stuff. And Amendment 18 is somewhere in there, but it's still this amount of stuff. So that's what I've heard in, 20 or more meetings. So now I'd like to hear your comments, because you guys have been spending a lot more time at this than I have. And by your comments, I mean the members of the council, but also there's a lot of people who've been sitting out in the audience for the better part of this day, too. I don't know. Why don't you referee this, Mr. Chair, because you have that aura about you that controls this unruly group.
I'm not too sure they're all that unruly. Another hour from now, they might be unruly. But anybody? I'm going to go to the audience first. Does anybody have a question of the new regional administrator? Eddie.
Hi, I'm Ed Barrett. I'm a commercial fisherman, and I'm also the president of Sector 10, which is pretty much the poster child for all the bad things that have happened in the last couple of years. Pretty much we were the model for the economic research that the governor used to make his first appeal for disaster relief. So everything that you talked about has happened to us. You know, everything from people losing houses to families having problems. And it's really, it's been very troubling. But I'd like to get back to something you had brought up about science. And what I have found in all these years that I've been part of any kind of management process is maybe not the lack of validity in the science, but where politics intersects in the science. And everyone in this room knows that politics interferes with the science. And for me right now, I pretty much, although I call my home port Plymouth, I've been pretty much living on my boat since May, fishing out of other ports. particularly in Nantucket Sound. Now, Nantucket Sound is essential fish habitat for juvenile cod. It's where they winter. And we're not really sure whether they're Western Georgia's cod or Gulf of Maine cod, but the council has deemed that this place is essential fish habitat. Now, we're about to embark on a four-year construction project on that. And as I've read the newspapers lately, it seems that, the fish, the Globe the other day said we were a dying industry. And that, and if you read the comments after that, pretty much the public, general public thinks that we overfished it. Well, we're about to start this industrial project on essential fish habitat at a time when we're looking at severe cutbacks in cod allocation, that there seems to be a big problem with cod in New England. Now, previously, maybe this wasn't the purview of the New England Council, the Cape Wind Project, but I think it is now. And my question is whether this council is going to address that and have the political courage to say, you know what, maybe these guys aren't overfishing. Maybe there are other things that are impacting these cod populations. Because 7 years from now, I can already hear it. I can already hear that once we've dredged and power driven in 500-foot structures, that there's no cod. So, what I'm looking for is the council to start considering everything, all the reasons why we don't have fish, and there's a lot of them. And it really, at this point, with all the controls on fishing and the fishing regulations over the last 15 years, it's become pretty evident that that a lot of the problems that we're facing right now aren't from fishing and from fishing regulations. That the council needs to expand its scope, address predator prey issues in the dogfish and the seals populations. They got to address the problems of industrial development of the ocean and impacts such as things like the MWRA pipe, scheduled to put 4 billion gallons a day of fresh, warm water into the Gulf of Maine ecosystem. So I guess that's kind of my challenge to you, John, as we go forward, I'd like to see something other than lip service given to these things. Thank you.
You'd like to see something other than what?
Lip service.
Anyone else in the audience have a comment? I can't see. Yep. Frank?
Good afternoon. I'm Frank Meraki. I fish from Scituate. I'm also a member of Sector 10. I'd just like to tell you a little bit about local fishing since you're in the town of Plymouth. The Sector 10 encompasses four ports primarily, Scituate, Green Harbor, Plymouth, and Sandwich, and we have a couple of outliers also on Cape Cod. But these are all small boat fishing ports, small boats meaning we have limited range, limited capacity. Basically, we wait for the fish to come to us. We don't go to the fish. This summer, the fish have not come to us. It's been an anomalous summer. Fish distributions have been very, very scarce. The best fishing season is presumably ahead of us, and in about a week, there's going to be a consequence closure to gillnet fishermen for harbor porpoises. Gillnet fishing comprises on the order of 30 to 40% of the landings of Sector 10. And without those landings, I really question the viability, the economic viability of our sector. At this point, we're behind on our trajectory of landings. We'll be further behind. We've had informal meetings of our members trying to figure out what we're going to do, and basically the answer is we don't have an answer. We'll try our best, but we don't have a plan to accommodate this. So I'd just like for the decision makers that are charged with the implementation of this porpoise closure to consider the fact that once a fishing community goes under, it's not going to come back. You know, once the ratchet turns, they're not creating any more waterfront real estate, and the connection of family lineages, once severed, is probably not going to be reconnected again. So weigh very carefully, please, the social and economic consequences of this closure. And going forward, please consider a better way of implementing pingers, if pingers are, in fact, the tool to obviate the take of harbor porpoises, that the resources be provided for better enforcement and better management of the effectiveness of the pingers to be sure that they work. Thank you very much for your consideration. Have a good evening.
Frank, I said earlier today, I don't think you were here, that I said we would, I announced on Friday when I met with folks up in Gloucester that I would make a decision by tomorrow, and I announced this morning that I would make that here at, when is after lunch, 1:15? 1:15 tomorrow. So we'll do that. Let me just give a little background on pingers, because it's instructive to remember that pingers were an invention of fishermen back in the early 90s. And I remember it because when I was doing economic assistance for NOAA, we had a program, you may remember, called Fishing Industry Grants. And we made a user-friendly program to get ideas from fishermen or fishermen partnerships with scientists to get them some money to develop ideas. And Eric Anderson and some other fishermen from Portsmouth came up with an idea called a pinger, and they thought that if they could get harbor porpoises to pay attention and turn their sonar on, that the porpoise wouldn't go into a gill net. And the scientists at the National Marine Fisheries Service didn't think that was going to work, actually. We were down on the idea. But we said, well, maybe you guys are right. And so we funded it with a fishing industry grant, and Eric and his crazy fishermen from New Hampshire and the scientists from Nova Scotia invented the pinger and tried it out, and harbor porpoise takes went from 1994, I think, about 1,600 deaths to 304 in 2004. And so without the fishermen's invention of pingers, the gillnet industry would be in some museum. It would be done with. There would be no gillnet fishery. It would be history, all over, done with, no gillnets. But fishermen invented the pinger, and it worked, and it still works. But it works if it's used, you know, with batteries that are fully charged and, you know, properly deployed. And if there were, you know, 304 harbor porpoise deaths this year, there wouldn't be any consequence closures. So that's the problem, is the fishermen deserve all the credit in the world for inventing a tool that worked and still works. And so we're going to have an announcement tomorrow at 1:15. I hope you come tomorrow, and we'll talk more about this at 1:15.
I thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thanks, Frank.
Anyone else in the? Yes.
My name is Jerry Sigler. I am from ESOL Technical Services, provider of observers to the groundfish fishery and to the skylop fishery. Mr. Bullard, you said a lot about the observers, and your concern is very, very valid and very valid for us as well. My question is your administration will support sectors financially to provide the observers, as well as helping the herring and mackerel fishery? Those fisheries cannot afford observers and the observers' cost. The observers are very important link between the science and what is going on out in the ocean. There is a dream for maybe everybody to have 100%, but this is not realistic. Reliable people, good people, cost money. And to get that information and present to the scientists to make a right management is a very, very important. It's critical. It's critical for sectors. It's critical for a lot of fisheries. Presently, sectors absolutely have no, the fishermen, small vessels, small operations, they have no way to finance operation on their own. The only remains question for government help or the help from other institutions to support that program. What will be your position?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the answer is. But I know I've heard about the way we record information from recording it when the fish come over the dock, over the deck, to the, when the fish go to the processor. And, you know, people copying stuff down on paper seven times and the inefficiencies. And I don't know what the answer is. I'm not bright enough, but I know there are a lot of bright people who can figure out that there must be a way to do this that delivers a better product at a lower cost in a much shorter time. And I'm not sure what it is yet, but I believe that if there are people who put their heads together, that there is a way to do this. And whether the savings go to the government or the boat owner or who it is, that we can get better information, more accurate information, quicker and cheaper. I'm not the person to figure it out. Boy, I can have a hard time turning my cell phone on. But there are people, I think, who can figure out a way to do it. I think there are inefficiencies in the way we do it right now that cost us a lot of money. What do you think?
Well, as a provider, we are not a government agency. We are not an organization, environmental organization. We provide skillful people. And if we will be approved to provide certain technologies or help, surely we can. But right now, the providers are contracted by the federal government, and we work under the federal government requirements and guidance. So right now we cannot do anything on our own.
My criticism is not of the individual observers. My criticism is of a system we have set up. I think from when the fish come over the deck to when the dealer's counting them, there's got to be a better way we can do this.
Surely. Thank you very much.
Anyone else? I see a hand back there. I can't see. Who would, award-winning Ron.
Hi, Ron Smallwoods, New England Fishery Management Council Award winner. The first public mic that the council had last spring, I talked about skate, so I just quickly want to bring that up again. I mean, obviously, John, you know I'm a farmer. And if I had a field full of kudzu, I wouldn't be worrying about trying to dish out my tomato or carrot or potato crops, because there's no way I could grow tomatoes, carrots in a field full of kudzu. There's too many damn skates out there. And I don't even can't even talk about dogfish, because we don't see them at scallop drags, and I've been towing scallop drags around a lot. You have to do something with skates before anything else is going to change. You have a biomass of yellowtail out there, and they could successfully spawn, and we would never know it because they are just getting gobbled up by skates. I just came back. I did 100 tows from Block Island around the southern edge with testing some gear up to the cultivator through Close Area 2, Close Area 1, caught 13,000 skates in 100 tows. And these are 30-minute tows where, you know, flatfish didn't, all flatfish together might have numbered up to 1,000. So without dealing with the skate issue, we are not going to make any progress. That's the bottom line. There should be a massive scientific, not modelers and statisticians. I mean, they could help define the problem. But we need descriptive biologists. We need ecologists. We need a major program using commercial fishing vessels out there. We have to find out why this ecosystem is screwed up. And I think the answer, obviously, we know there's a seal issue, which is another whole issue that has to be dealt with. But we have a skate issue that's ubiquitous from New Jersey up to Maine. And everything else is immaterial. You know, we're not going to solve anything until we deal with skates. That's the bottom line. There, research issues, you know, people talk about side by side with the Bigelow. We did that back with the council back in the late 70s with the Friesland. Jake Dykstra, you know, we pair towed. I was port captain. I was before I was captain of the Albatross. And the Friesland outfished, you know, the Albatross 10 to 1. I mean, that's what a pair-by comparison would be doing. What would be more important is to get a couple of commercial fishing vessels, rig them up the same way the Bigelow is rigged up, and triple the number of stations during the survey, and then see how that improves your accuracy and precision. Some of the things that might be happening out there is the yellowtail might be getting in a denser formation, so there's you have a harder time hitting them during the surveys. If you do more tows, you might be able to see an answer to that. There's a host of other things that are descriptive research efforts, not sitting back, going through the statistics and models and saying, oh, we have a retrospective pattern. But the number one thing is skates. Everything else is immaterial.
Anyone else in the audience? Yep.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Reardon. I'm the sector manager for Northeast Fisheries Sector 10 and also Northeast Fisheries Sector 6. But my concern today is the consequent closure that's going to affect the boats in Sector 10. And, Mr. Bull, we already had this discussion prior to, so please bear with me as I repeat it again. But we're facing a consequence closure with 16.7% of the gillnet fishery period for access in fishing year 2012, 61 days, is scheduled to be denied beginning October 1st. What I'm concerned from a sector manager standpoint is ace utility. We're not going to be able to access our ace. We're not going to be able to support the sector, as Frank indicated. Cash flow considerations aside, I requested a search by the Northeast Fishery Sector Program, Northeast Fishery Observer Program, and it was conducted by Gina Field and Amy Van Hatten last week. And what I did, the search was for all the 54 permits associated with Sector 10 presently. We went back to January of 1999. During the period January 1999 to the present, there have only been two harbor porpoise takes in the Gulf of Maine by those Sector 10 permits, by all those vessels, only two. But to make this even more substantial was the fact that during that period, we had a zero pinger non-compliant. We had 100% compliance on pingers. There was no indication that there was no compliance on pingers. We had there was 2009 NEFOP trips during that period with 5,877 pingers deployed and with 5,875 pingers hauled back. NEF's 10 ASM records since the beginning of sector management, May 1st, 2010 to the present, indicated there were 1,041 total ETSI monitor trips included with 364 pinger required trips with pingers installed in compliance. 5,158 nets were deployed with 5,476 pingers hauled back on these trips. We're in 100% support of the Northeast Seafood Coalition recommendation that the closure be delayed until February 15th. And we also have the opportunity to present more data for the upcoming, the tactical force, whatever it's called, take reduction team. The other thing is that, one of the things that we're really concerned, we've had a complete, as we've been pointed out numerous times today during this meeting, and as you're all aware of it, Kevin Friedland's article a few weeks ago indicated that we have anomalous oceanographic circumstances happening right now. The water temperature is 65 degrees. The species, the hobby porpoise Fica fecina, is a cold water species. Okay, according to the NOAA Technical Memorandum, National Marine Fisheries Northeast 219, U.S. Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico Marine Mammal Stock Assessments, 2010, December, harbor porpoise, Gulf of Maine Bay of Fundy stock population trends for this species have not been investigated. That's stated right in that technical data. And I understand that there is another assessment being conducted right now. But the process wherein, if you look at the data relative to that last stock assessment, the Bigelow, or maybe it was the Albatross at the time, I don't know, but all the research was done in June, July, and August. Okay, the harbor porpoise supposedly don't show up until October. Okay, we're concerned that some of the data may not be correct, as we've pointed out many times with a lot of the stock assessments that the means by which the data is collected is probably not correct. The other consideration is that if we consider the harbor porpoise eating 20 pounds of fish a day, if we assume that they are 100-pound fish, 100-pound animal, 100-pound mammal, and they eat 20 pounds of fish a day, they're consuming 7,300 pounds of fish a year. They live for 50 years. So those two harbor porpoise, and I'm not speaking against protecting the harbor porpoise. I'm only indicating something that has to be considered in ecosystem-based management. In 50 years, each harbor porpoise is consuming over 50,000 pounds of fish. Is that right? I'm nervous, as you can probably tell by my voice, but I'm very nervous. But 50 years, 7,300 pounds, that's 360,000 pounds of fish that each harbor porpoise is consuming in a lifetime. Those are considerations and variables that we have to consider as well. I just really hope that you really take these, and I know you're taking these considerations to heart. And I really hope that you do support the Northeast Seafood Coalition request. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Anybody on the council have comments or questions for the regional administrator? Dave?
Yeah, I actually, since I attended the public listening session and I felt that it was the public's listening session, all I did is listen in Portsmouth. But I do have some comments as an individual and as a council member, because I think what I'm hearing, and I've heard it now at several meetings and I've read summaries in the newspapers of a number of the meetings, is this immense amount of frustration out there in the fishing public. There's a sense that there's a large minority of people, it may actually be a majority in numbers, who feel that they simply aren't being listened to by fisheries management. And I think that's an issue that you as the regional administrator are going to have to deal with, this enormous amount of frustration. And I get on to groundfish, and you've mentioned the book that I was in. I'm going to give you another book, a homework assignment. It's Spencer Apollonio wrote a book on the failure of groundfish management in New England. Came out, I don't know, what, 4 or 5 years ago maybe. And I think it's more important today than ever because it chronicles his life on the council back in the 70s and the 80s, and it actually goes all the way up into the early 2000s. But when we've gotten to the point after 40 years of groundfish management in New England that we have to declare a fisheries disaster, I would say you have to admit that groundfish management has failed. It has failed entirely. Not just this council, previous councils, going all the way back to the very beginning of this entire process, which I've been involved in since 1967, before there even was a Magnuson Act. And my feeling is that when something fails, you have to examine it wholesale and figure out why it's failed. And I think Dave Preble pointed this out to me at the last groundfish committee, so I'm going to use it. I think it was Einstein that said, but I haven't had a chance to look it up, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. And that's exactly what we've done in groundfish management for 40 years now. We keep doing the same thing over and over, and we keep expecting a different result, and we never get it. So to me, and I've tried to examine this very carefully in the last month, I think several things have to be admitted. This is a multi-species fishery. All these fish interact with each other. Single-species management may work at low levels of abundance, but single-species management is and will continue to be a failure in a multi-species fishery. And that's why I referenced Spencer Apollonio, because they wrestled with this back in the 70s. And they kept setting individual quotas, and they tried a whole manner of things that were all revolved around single-species management, and they all failed. And yet here we are, 40 years later, still doing single-species management and expecting a different result. The second issue I want to bring up is, again, addressed, in his book quite well. There has been a consistent deflection of the groundfish problem. There is a tyranny of the majority in groundfish that continues to move forward groundfish management measures to protect the powerful. In this process, the winners eat the losers, and they don't even spit out the bones. They don't care. And quite frankly, the National Marine Fisheries Service, I feel, is supposed to be the arbiter of fairness and equity. You have the ability to reject segments of council amendments. You can reject the entire amendment. You can reject a portion of it. Send it back. And that has not been done. And so this majority continues to move on. And, you know, for example, in Amendment 16, I wrote a dissenting opinion. And it was ignored, in my opinion. And everything that I wrote in that dissenting opinion has come true. I warned this council at the time, and now you've just discussed Amendment 18. We wouldn't need Amendment 18 if we'd done Amendment 16 right in the first place. If there had been a referendum, if a requirement, as you mentioned, if a requirement of Amendment 16 had been a referendum on the allocation, we would not be here today discussing Amendment 18. Because that referendum would have never passed with the allocation scheme that was put forward, because it disenfranchised the majority of the people. And in order to get something that would have passed, you would have had to give the majority something. They would have to give enough to people that 66 2/3% of them would have voted for that referendum to move forward. And because we didn't, we are exactly reaping the benefits today of everything that happened at that time. So I personally believe you would have had a very different product if you'd had a referendum. And I think groundfish would be in a lot better place than they are right now, because I do believe who fishes matters and who catches what matters. And I really believe that very strongly, that a number of people can get by on a relatively small amount of fish, and we can have relatively high employment in fishery. Or, as you said, we can let it go to three or four corporate interests that own the entire thing, employ relatively few people, and may wreak indescribable damage on fishery habitat and on the fisheries for a lifetime that may last for generations, and the damage won't be able to be undone in the remainder of my lifetime. So I think it's time for this council and for the National Marine Fisheries Service to examine an entirely different way of doing business with groundfish. That may require some changes to Magnuson. I personally think it just requires broader interpretation of what's already there. I think we already have the tools. But to sit here on the verge of Armageddon next year and say we're going to do the same thing again that we've done for the last 40 years and expect that somehow groundfish this time are magically going to come out better than they were, I think is pure folly. And as an individual, I will not be able to vote for things that I think are going to just perpetrate the myths that we've presented for the last 40 years. Thank you.
David Pierce.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate the opportunity to offer some views, and of course, we've already done so, and we'll do so as time goes on, since you are incredibly receptive to anything and everything as to how we can define success and move forward in a real positive way, being sensitive to what the fishing industry is faced with now. During your earlier remarks today, you praised the Magnuson Act, and yes, I always keep a copy with me. It's not the Bible, but it's extremely useful, and it is well done. I agree with much of what you said early on regarding the Magnuson Act. I guess my suggestion to you is, relative to the Magnuson Act, because NOAA Fisheries is now focusing on National Standard Number 1 guidelines, is receptive to ideas as to how those guidelines should be revisited and perhaps revised in some way, my advice is that, well, my hope is that your office will be very much involved in a discussion of the revisions to the National Standard Number 1 guidelines in the context of what New England is experiencing. Now, obviously, they're national standards. It's not just New England. It's the entire nation. And there may not be similar problems in other parts of the nation, but I suspect there are. But certainly here, it's quite severe. Now, you have the benefit of sitting next to George Darcy. George Darcy is an author of a paper describing national standard guidelines, congressional intent, implicit intent of Congress. It's a good paper that he co-authored with, I think, Gary Matlock. And I think, George, you were involved as well with the development of those guidelines. I'm not exactly sure, but I know you had a strong role. So you've got the benefit of George and his experience, and, of course, his experiences with groundfish management and the like since the guidelines were implemented. So I'm hopeful that you'll take a real close look with your staff, and you've got an excellent staff in the regional office. There's no question about that. You've acknowledged that already, and they'll be able to provide you with great guidance, but I would say just hold their feet to the fire on this one because you understand the implications of it. They do, too, but I think you're kind of setting the sail on this issue, and hopefully, you know, your staff will follow along, and that Silver Spring will also pay attention to what you and you will be able to offer them once again in the context of what's happening here in New England. Second point is Amendment Number 18. I'm very happy that you have focused on Amendment 18, consolidation, excessive shares. Your listening sessions have brought a lot to light. Certainly, I've dealt with it quite intensively through my dealings with Sector 10 and other sectors, dealing with individuals who were dramatically disadvantaged by the allocation formula adopted by the Council through Amendment 16. There are winners and losers. Well, now we have a lot of losers. And unfortunately, those who were doing okay are now doing not very well at all. And I'm very glad that the council, in its letter sent to the Secretary of Commerce, attached the NOAA Fisheries, Division of Marine Fisheries, SMS break-even analysis that does an excellent job describing the status of the ground fisheries in 2009 and 2010, never mind 11 and 12. It's much worse than what it was then. So keep focused on these key issues and assist to the extent that your office can. Assist us work through these very hairy issues related to continuing consolidation and excessive shares, however they may be defined, especially as we get closer and closer to May 1 and things worsen by leaps and bounds. And I'll offer one other thing. I have a list, but I'll pare it down to these three. Law enforcement. Clearly, we have federal law enforcement that's doing a good job, as good a job as they can possibly do, and you are being advised by law enforcement as to what's happening throughout New England, certainly in Massachusetts, Massachusetts Bay, everywhere regarding what's working and what's not working, what's being enforced, what's not being enforced, and what is enforceable. I would hope that in your dealings with them, federal law enforcement, you also take the time to acquire a firsthand understanding of law enforcement concerns from the state perspective. The state, Massachusetts, the other states, but certainly Massachusetts helps out in a major way with law enforcement enforcing federal rules through the agreements that we have. Well, I suspect that if you are able to take the time to listen to what they have to say as to what's working, what's not working, what's being enforced, what's not being enforced at all, where there might be chaos, where there may be a Wild West situation, they can help. I don't know what your federal law enforcement officers have told you, but I know what my enforcement officers have told me, and it's disturbing. So you can learn from that. This is key. As we move forward with continued restrictions and more pressure on the fishing industry to do whatever it needs to do to survive. And obviously, survival is going to be hard for many people. So those are my three pod button issues.
Anyone else in the council? Well,
if there's no one else, I want to just quickly respond to Dave, and that is I appreciate the council's comments, at least the ones you've made, and hope that the rest of you will. I left business cards, and hope you will either buttonhole me during breaks or email me or call me. Because I am new, and the relationship between the regional office, between me and the council, is an important one, and it's brand new for me. So whatever the relationship is between the regional administrator and the council is a clean slate from my standpoint, right? So your advice on how to make that work is really important, so I appreciate it. And I think that the challenge, I mean, there's a bunch of them, but the challenge that Dave lays out is a really tricky one because, you know, we've been bouncing along the bottom for the better part of 40 years. And, you know, with the decisions that we mentioned that Dave talks about, you know, when we go to make decisions on yellowtail and other things like that, where we're going to be measuring how do we keep people in business? How do, because we're in the razor's edge of that. You know, we're going to run the risk in every one of those decisions where we're trying to keep people in business. Every one of those decisions are going to keep us bouncing along the bottom for the next 40 years. So how do we go about getting to a point where we're not bouncing along the bottom? And do we see a way to abundance. Do we see a way to abundance? How do we get there? And so I don't have the answer to that. But I don't want the next 40 years to be, you know, like the last 40 years, where we're just, you know, bouncing along the bottom. And so how do we do that? So your ideas on that, that's just about abundance of stocks. The whole issue that you raised as well about ownership, about diversity, about access, there are a lot of tricky issues here, a lot of tough decisions. How we work together, I want to know how we do that. Lots of interesting problems to wrestle to the ground. I have a ton of respect for your mission, your job. I want to know how we do this together. So thank you for your time, your input. As Bogie said, this could be the beginning of a, what did he say? I never get that quote right. A wonderful relationship.
Beautiful friendship.
Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone, for today. We will start tomorrow at 8:30.